and into the most minute detail of your life. So Harry Brown is quite correct about the flat tax. I don't think that is much of a solution either, even though there's many people like the Cato Institute, et cetera, promoting that. And he says one of the big results of this would be to neutralize government, is his way of putting it. Politicians will no longer have the resources to cripple the economy and ruin everyone's life. And and then he talks about how, this, as it is written right now, there's no limit to how much they can tax us. And that's always been true. You know, it started out the income tax way back in 1913. They said, we're going to use about 2 to 4%, and it's only going to be on the ultra rich. And and then someone said, well, you know, they could even go up to 10%. There's no real limitation there. And they were just laughing. It would never get that high. And of course, now what's it doing? Of course, it's been as high as 90% at different times for the wealthy. And it's affecting the average American. Just, we all know what it's like. It was never meant to be this way. It's why the original Constitution said twice, no direct taxation. What's that mean? That means the federal government are going up against the lone individual. How in the world could you possibly not have an abusive situation in that kind of predicament? There's just no way. It's set up, it's inherently set up for abuse. That's why I often say the income tax is inherently anti-liberty, anti-Bill of Rights, anti-Constitution. And that's why we have to abolish this second plank to the Communist Manifesto. You have to take that Communist Manifesto and look at it and just think about how much it has manifested itself here in the United States. You'd be really surprised how far along the road we have come on Karl Marx's road. Well, this is Tom Clooney. I see we're getting towards the end of our show here. I would really like to thank everyone for being here, and I'll be with you again next Monday evening from 7 to 8 on KSR 89.9 FM. Thank you.
Hell here on earth, in some city schoolyard. When bullets and birth control outnumber books, something's wrong. There's a hunger for good news and heroes.
Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But Please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us a very special guest. His name is Bruce Brander, and he is, of course, he's a writer. He's been on the editorial board of the National Geographic. He's traveled the world for World Vision that you've been working for recently?
Well, yes, I worked for 14 years for World Vision, which is the big relief and development agency. And just traveling the globe, covering a lot of crises like the genocide in Rwanda and the anarchy in Somalia and Bosnia, places like that.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you've written an amazing, amazing book. It's called Staring into Chaos, and we've had Mr. Brander on one of our other programs. We want you to hear what he has to say tonight, though, because I think this book is so important, because it is basically a review of all the philosophy books that you're going to find out there. Why don't you sort of pick up the story of how you happened to write the book, would you please?
Well, yes, Doctor. I don't like to say this is my book, because what I did is condense the work of some of the real great, really great scholars and thinkers who were dealing with the disintegration of Western civilization, Western culture. This would be American and European, and really it covers the whole world, because Western culture is like an umbrella covering everywhere. And I think we're quite conscious these days that there is a disintegration going on. And I became aware of this as a traveling journalist, and as a single man, I was living sort of like a camera. I didn't have much personal life, but I was seeing a lot of things all over the world, and I became just very concerned I saw that something was terribly wrong with the way our culture is telling us how to live. And the purpose of a culture, of course, is to produce relatively healthy and wholesome creatures, like aquaculture produces healthy fish, and good agriculture produces healthy plants. Well, a human culture, ideally, if it's functioning well, should produce good, reasonably wholesome, happy, contented people. And our culture wasn't doing it. It was fouling people's lives and ruining people's lives and rendering life meaningless for so many people. So after floundering about wondering what was going on for a long time, I discovered there is a vast body of wonderful literature on this subject. And most people don't know terribly much about it, because it's not accessible to the average person. It's very difficult reading and very long studies. And shall I mention the...
Yes, please do, because I think it's important for people to know where you got your information from and why. Of course, most people have never heard of it, because most people don't have the time to read it.
No, that's true. And some of these people that I mention in my book are well known. George Orwell, who wrote 1984, and Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World. And these people are well known, but they're the ones I dwelt upon primarily. For Oswald Spengler, who is a German historian, philosopher, he had a massive intellect, and one of these people that knows practically everything, and he wrote a book that's pretty well known. It's called The Decline of the West. And he wrote this during the First World War, and it's still in print today. And what he did, he studied 8 civilizations and found a pattern in their rise and their decline and their collapse, and he placed modern Western culture in that pattern. More or less, I'd say perhaps one-third down the slope of decline. Far from the bottom, so we're on the way down, as he saw it. And he was a very pessimistic man. And then, shortly afterwards, during the Second World War, Arnold Toynbee, who was the premier historian of the 20th century, and he wrote, he spent 40 years studying every single civilization known to history, about 24 of them, and he... wrote a study of history, and this is where it gets hard. It's 3 million words long, just an ocean of typography. It's 7,000 pages, 12 volumes, and it's a wonderful study, but who can read it? And even scholars have a hard time making time to read this. It takes about 8 months to go through it thoroughly. And then there was one more major social thinker I dealt with, Pterim Sorokin. He's not as well known, but he was one of these gigantic intellects. He was a Russian who participated in the Russian Revolution against Lenin, and Lenin was going to have him shot, and he escaped Russia and came over to the States, and he was a brilliant man, and he rather quickly became the chairman of the sociology department at Harvard University, which is the leading sociology university at the time. And he spent 10 years with other scholars helping him, studying, the way he put it, he didn't call it rise and fall of civilization. He studied fluctuations in Western culture where from the spiritual, a strongly spiritual culture, and like a pendulum swing, it goes over to the materialistic side and goes only so far, becomes too materialistic, and then swings back toward the spiritual. And he felt that we were at the very, very bitter end of the what he called the sensate culture, the materialistic culture and the non-spiritual culture, and that we're beginning a swing back to what we might even think of as a spiritual renaissance.
In fact, the one thing I got reading your book was the fact that you felt that if we did not have a spiritual renaissance, we'd be in real trouble, because without some concept of God or a higher being, society really can't survive. People can't survive. They almost become, like animals, just destroying one another.
Well, yes, Dr. Stanley, if we stop to consider the spiritual, or the psychologist would say the emotional faculty of that part of us, is one-third of our being. We're body and we're intellect, and then there's their spirit or the emotional part of us that the psychologists study. And if we don't develop that, which we are not developing that in our culture, we become a sick society. And, a society is a group of people, and a sick society is a group of sick people. And our sickness is emotional, spiritual, because we have been neglecting this part of our being. Just to back up what you were saying, the French thinker André Malraux made a statement that the 21st century will be spiritual or it will not be.
And, of course, you had referred to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Both these great, great Russian writers had, of course, emphasized the spiritual necessity if man is to survive.
Well, they were saying way back when, this was in the 19th century, both Tolstoy and Dostoevsky were warning Russia against westernizing, because they felt that the Western civilization was in for an enormous collapse. And the reason they felt this is because they felt that we had lost our moorings to God, and that we still had a form of churchism, as it were, but the churches were compromising with the secular and materialistic society so much that they were losing their own spirit. And they warned Russia against copying the West, which Russia went ahead and did anyway.
Well, of course, it's very interesting. Most people, when they talk about what you're talking about, usually go to Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But, of course, you've certainly emphasized these more contemporary writers, Spengler, Tolstoy, and the others, and they basically all telling exactly the same thing. Society cannot continue going the way it's going. And, of course, most people can't imagine that our wonderful society could be destroyed. And yet, if you study history, if you believe the Bible, why Babylon was destroyed in a day. And, of course, the story of the Old Testament is time and time and time again, when civilizations were destroyed in a very short period of time. What part do wars play in the destruction of civilization?
Well, the wars will speed up any social change that's going on. It accelerates it. And we saw that especially with the First World War, because Victorian society, which was sort of the old world society, persisted right up until 1914. You could consider that to be Victorian still. But then after that war, a whole new society broke out all of a sudden, the Roaring Twenties and looser moral patterns and the whole lot, that we have developed since then into our own society. But it happened very suddenly. There are many people during World War One who did expect, very firmly expected, that as soon as the war ended, things would be back the way they were. And, of course, that was very, very much not the case, because the wars accelerated social changes that were going on already, but weren't as noticeable.
And the inference of your book was that really period around the 1890s, when sometime there, why Queen Victoria, what was it, 1898, something like that, Queen Victoria celebrated, I think, 60 years on the throne, and this great festivities in England, that was sort of the high point of Western civilization. Was that your interpretation?
Well, the high point in appearances.
In appearances, I'm saying.
In appearances. Right. It was a grand. They had a big parade through London, and many, many, many people came, and they had all the regiments and battalions and what else, the armies from all over the empire, and it was a grand display, and Queen Victoria and her open Landau carriage came down and to the vast cheering of the crowds, and it was a grand time for Western culture from appearances, but of course it was already rotting from within, because the elite were playing around with drugs already. That had been prominent since the poet Baudelaire, who was branded his school was branded the decadent poets. They were playing around with that sort of thing, and the elites were experimenting with sexual dalliances more than usual, and various odd behaviors, and the sort of things that we are taking in stride today. But they begin with the elite and filter down through the classes after about 100, 150 years, and then the decay was beginning already, very, very clearly in Victorian times.
Yeah, well, that was a little over 100 years ago now.
Yeah.
And, of course, we see really what's happening in America today, and we don't understand it. It's the end result of the decay of our culture, because, of course, we've turned our back on tradition. And, of course, England has really, of course, been accelerated in its fall as the power that England once had has been transferred to the United States. But, of course, I wonder if America will have the power as long as Great Britain did, because we seem to be almost on a course of self-destruction today.
Well, we do. And I just personally I'm speculating. I don't mention this in my book, and I wouldn't write it, but I do wonder if we might turn out to be the new Rome, pulling things together with simple force of might, as Rome did. It's an interesting speculation. I really shouldn't carry it too far.
Well, but I think it's a very legitimate speculation. We have troops in 140 nations today. Some military presence, and now, according to Congressman Ron Paul, Rome never had that presence in the world. The world wasn't that organized at that time, and there weren't that many nations.
Sure.
But, of course, we really are. We're using our military and our financial power. We are installing in country after country leaders that the people may not necessarily want at all. I saw we're in Afghanistan. Now we're providing security for the president there. I think his name Ricard is, something of the sort.
Yes.
So we're providing security for him, and of course we have our troops in Georgia to keep Shevardnadze in power, and we are doing everything we can to keep unpopular rulers in power, just exactly as the Romans kept King Herod in power in ancient Israel.
Sure enough. You know, what I liked about this study, Dr. Monteith, is I began with, I'm a believer, too, and I began with a sense of moral decline. That was my main concern. And preachers will stress that. And sociologists stress the decline of the family and other relationships. And psychologists will stress the deterioration of mental health and the rising suicide rate and that sort of thing. Then the environmentalists down in South Africa right now stress the decay of the environment. But these studies, what I liked about these studies is that they pulled it all together. These three men I mentioned, Spengler, Toynbee, and Sorokin, had these gigantic intellects. And they studied the whole culture in every one of his departments, in all the fine arts, which they found to be in confusion, in law and ethics, which they found to be also slipping. Philosophy is gone, really, for practical purposes. Religion is not doing so well, and social relationships are doing very poorly, and marriage and that sort of thing. But they found that the and this is where they clarify things, some parts of the culture are still healthy. And the optimists look at these. And one of them is the economics, or the production of wealth, which is shaky, but nonetheless, it's still, we're rich people. And we're doing very well in that regard for the time being, at least. And all the optimists will point to science and technology, and really, these twin sister arts are the strongest and healthiest parts of our culture, and they are, too. They're very, very strong, science and technology, and are likely to remain so for some time to come. But unfortunately, they're influenced by the taintedness, the sickness in the rest of the culture, and tend to produce some terrible things like atomic bombs and biological weapons and stuff like that. Even the healthy parts of our culture, which indeed are there, are a danger because of the unhealthy parts.
Well, I certainly agree with you. Well, our guest today is Bruce Brander, his book, Staring into Chaos. And for those of you out there in the listening audience, most of you don't have 7 months to read Toynbee or the time to read Oswald Spengler or the others. This is really a very convenient means of getting the kernels of their thought laid out in a very, very convenient manner. It's how many pages is it?
Oh, golly, it's about 360. It's a normal size book.
Right, it's hardcover. And if you're interested in knowing how to get that, of course, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. I think it's a fascinating, fascinating book. Because, of course, if you don't understand the past, you can't understand what's happening today. If you don't understand what's happened to other civilizations, what's happening to America today is nothing new at all. And, of course, Spengler had found simply summarizing 8 civilizations. Every one of them followed the same path. And this was, of course, he was writing, wasn't he, in the era of the First World War. And, of course, people were beginning to wonder what was going on in the world. I mean, this was, in many ways, such a fratricidal war. I mean, here we are having Christian nation fighting Christian nation. We end up destroying the German Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Turkish Empire and the Russian Empire. And just this dramatic destruction of so much of the past. And even England, of course, that time began moving towards socialism, as did Italy and France. The world was never the same after that war. And even after the Second World War, even more dramatic changes.
Well, what I found fascinating is that when I was writing this book, the older people of the society had seen the dissolution of 10 major empires, major global empires, all at once, which is more collapse than anything that's ever been seen since the cutoff point of ancient Rome, the end of ancient Rome. And these social thinkers pointed out that our time, if they are correct, I mean, there has to be room for error here, but if their analyses are correct, our time is one of the great tidal changes of all history. And it's equal to the Renaissance as a major change, or to the decline of ancient Rome as a major change. And the world has seen changes like this only about a half a dozen times before. So if indeed their studies are right, we sure do live in interesting times.
Well, if you are out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-245-4237. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or, as I say, 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. And we're talking about Staring into Chaos, which is a fascinating look into what has happened in the past in an effort to understand what indeed is going on in America today. Now, of course, you've traveled throughout the world and written extensively for National Geographic. It must have been a fascinating, fascinating life to be able to see all these different cultures.
Well, it was, Doctor. And, I started traveling at the age of 18 as a merchant seaman because I was just eager to see the world, and that's the way to see it without much money. And then I was drafted into the Army and volunteered for overseas service and got it. And then right after university, I was restless again, and I had a teaching degree and worked my passage to New Zealand on a tramp steamer, and it took about 3 months to get there. Interestingly, I flew there in less than 24 hours this year from Colorado Springs. But anyway, I taught school down there and then slipped into journalism and liked it and was very successful at it and went on from there, writing for big publications and eventually landing on National Geographic. But yes, it was fascinating. It's a hard life. People used to say when I was on Geographic, oh, what a wonderful life you have, as if it were one long vacation. But it's not. It's hard, hard work.
And, of course, I don't enjoy traveling. I enjoy staying at home and with my books and my studies. And, always on the road, living out of a suitcase really is not that much fun.
Well, it was. For me, I liked it when I was single. I was single for quite a long time, actually. And I'd travel with 8 suitcases and 2 trunks, all my possessions packed in there, and I'd have to travel by ship usually, which is quite nice. And I'd shift countries every couple of years. And this was when I was freelancing. But then I landed in Milwaukee on the staff of the University of Wisconsin for a time and ended up married, and I don't like traveling now either. I've got 4 kids at home, and it gets into your system to the point where if I don't travel, I get really restless. But I spent a month in New Zealand this year so far and a couple of trips to Latin America last year, so I still do travel, but it is nice being home, as you say.
Well, of course, this whole idea of looking at the geopolitics of the world, you know, most people don't like to analyze what's going on. I think that the big problem we have today is most people have so little knowledge of history or really what has happened in the past. In fact, most people cannot tell you when the Roman Empire began, when the Roman Empire ended, why it ended, what the forces that were at work there, or see the similarities between what happened in Rome and what's happening in America today.
Well, you know, I think that most people don't even see the social changes going on today because we are so tired. I think we're so weary of seeing things going wrong around us that we just don't want to pay too much attention anymore. And I think our main hope today is not that life will become appreciably better, but that it simply won't become a lot worse. And of course, the terrorism strike last year has confirmed this. And I don't mean to be speaking like a pessimist, because I think before we sign off, we ought to get into the optimistic side of things. But there is a downside, and we're living with it, and I really think we have to deal with it because it's dealing with us.
Well, we have no choice. We're sort of, somebody once said, we're all on a spaceship Earth, and there is no way off of that. Or this idea, there was a song many years ago, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Unfortunately, we don't have that luxury.
Well, you know, Toynbee was a very clever man, the English historian, and he found in all deteriorating or declining or disintegrating cultures common tendencies among the people to escape. And some escape into hedonism, into pleasures and very short-term pleasures, and of course they mess up their lives in so doing. And he said others escape into the past, into archaism, as he called it. And he said the past beckons like a cozy home, so the people want to go back. And we see a lot of that, even in among religious people, back to the Bible, and back to basics in education, and back to Victorian morality, but of course back is gone, and that doesn't work. We have to go forward. We're not Victorian people, and we just have to go forward into uncharted territory. And he found some people try to escape into futurism, as he called it, which would be the grand socialist paradise or communist paradise or the rocket ships going off to colonize outer space, that sort of thing. And this is all grand leaps over the present into some glorious future, which is not likely to happen anyway. And he found other people retreat into the sanctuary of their own souls, as it were. They detach themselves, perhaps into books and intellectual pursuits, just disconnect themselves from everything else, the philosophers. The Buddhists did that. Buddha was not a religious leader at first. He was a philosopher. And he preached withdrawal. But Toynbee found the only solution, the only escape from a deteriorating society, is what he called transfiguration, and there we get into spiritual again, a spiritual growth, because then it really doesn't matter, it matters, but only outside ourselves, what happens around ourselves, because we're growing anyway.
Oh, well, yeah. Of course, Toynbee was not coming from a Christian perspective at all, was he?
Well, no, he wasn't. He was raised as an English Anglican, and he threw it off, and he declared himself to be an agnostic. And somebody told me in the last part of his life he became Christian again, but I don't know if that's true or not. But he declared himself, when he was writing, to be an agnostic. And at the same time, he said in his book, he said that our only salvation is to pray to God for a reprieve. In other words, to reach upward to the spiritual realm. And another point in his book, and he wasn't speaking in terms of faith, but in terms of historical reasoning, and he said, our only hope is Jesus Christ. and he sounds like Christian preaching.
Certainly has that ring of Christianity to it. I had no idea that he had actually at any time had manifest that belief.
But, he said just those words, and what he meant, of course, was following the teachings of Jesus, which would bring us out of this.
Right. Benjamin Franklin had actually expressed very, very similar feelings, and there's certainly no one would ever accuse him of being a Christian as such, and yet he recognized, and he said, you know, if we would only live by the tenets of Christianity, it would be a wonderful society. If any society would live by those tenets, it would be a great society. Even though he didn't necessarily believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, he recognized the necessity to have that belief in something far greater than ourselves. And, of course, he found meaning in the teachings of Christianity.
Well, you know, Dr. Monteith, another way one of the other social philosophers who I didn't mention by name, in fact, I can't even think of his name for sure, I deal with about 20 of them, he mentioned that all cultures, and all the social thinkers in this book who deal with religion say that all cultures begin with a religion, all civilizations begin with a religion, and then around the religious core, they build the culture or the civilization. They have arts and music and drama, literature, all around the religion, built upon the religion, and their ethics and their law and their human relationships, and it's all built on this religious core. And over the centuries, the civilization builds more and more and more and more. And then they begin to feel they're terribly clever, and they drop the religion. We don't need this anymore. This is just superstition. Look at this wonderful thing we built. And what happens is that the core withers away, and the civilization is hollow, and as the poet says, the center will not hold, and the whole thing just implodes. And that's where we apparently are today. Ready for a civilization implosion.
Well, of course, one only has to read the Old Testament to see that happening again and again and again to the Jewish nation. And in fact, it didn't take them very long to turn from their beliefs with Moses after escaping from the land of Egypt. Moses was gone, 10, 15 days, something like that, up on Mount Sinai, and boy, they had the golden calf all made, and they were whooping it up, you know. And there is this tendency, I think, inherent within man to turn against God. It seems to be nothing unique in America. It's been seen over and over and over again throughout the ages.
Well, yes, and you know, interestingly, Toynbee mentioned the Jewish people too, and he said their saving grace over the centuries and the millennia is that they had a sense of sin. They did not blame other people for their misfortunes. Toynbee points out, as some of these other thinkers do too, that no civilization is destroyed from the outside. They're all destroyed from within. And if somebody attacks them and defeats them, that means simply that they were pretty well rotten to begin with.
Well, I fear that is exactly what is happening to America today. And in fact, Abraham Lincoln had expressed that very thought many years ago when he wrote, you know, at what point should we expect the approach of danger? By what means should we fortify ourselves against it? Should we expect some transatlantic giant to step the ocean and crush us with a blow? And he said, never, never in 1,000 years could they take a drink from the Ohio or make a mark on the Blue Ridge. Then at what point should we expect the approach of danger? And I answer, if it ever reaches, it will spring up among us. It can never come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its authors and its finishers. As a nation of free men, we shall live through all time or die by suicide. And many respects, as I think of that statement, I think we are dying by suicide today. We're going to have to take a 3-minute break here. And if you'd like to get a cup of coffee or a drink of water or something, and we'll be right back with Bruce Brander discussing his book, Staring into Chaos. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and If you're out there across America listening to us, or even here in the Central Coast of California, we hope that many of you will recognize that you're going to hear a lot of things here that you're not going to hear elsewhere. A lot of discussions, a lot of information, and perhaps probing into the real problems for the malaise that is progressively engulfing our society today. So if you would like to become part of our team and help us in what we are doing, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. Many people join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Others subscribe to the newsletter. If you're out there and you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, that's a free copy of our newsletter. We'd be glad to send it to you. Just give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And our latest newsletter deals with vaccines. And, of course, my concern, because we hear a talk about forcing people to take vaccines. Now, vaccines are supposedly there to protect us from disease. So why do they want to force us to take them? I would think if there were no questions at all, everybody would want to take a vaccine if it had been proven to be safe. But that is the question. Are they always necessarily safe? Well, I think you'll enjoy, well, perhaps you won't enjoy it, but you'll be very interested in our latest newsletter. And as they say, if you'd like to get a copy of that latest newsletter and you haven't had one before, the telephone number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to go to our website. That's radioliberty.com, and pull down the various things we have up there. We hope that you'll certainly want to tell other people about our programs and tell them about our website. And, of course, at radioliberty.com, www.radioliberty.com, you can get our programs not only live 5 hours a day, and although 3 hours on Radio Liberty, 1 hour on the American Freedom Network, 1 hour on the Genesis Network, and there are links to the American Freedom Network, and tells you how to get the GCNLive.com program in the afternoon. And then there are all sorts of archive programs there going back over 4 to 6 weeks. We encourage you, if you'd like to actually copy any of those programs and send them out to your friends. We need to have the information readily available, and we have no objection to copying our newsletters, copying our programs, copying anything we've written, and help us to disseminate that information across America. If we cannot get the American people to think, to understand, and maybe we can't, but we have to try, because I look upon my ministry as the watchman that is described in Ezekiel 33. Our job is to tell others what happens, remembering in the final analysis that the battle is the Lord's. Well, this evening our special guest is Bruce Brander, and of course he's written a book, Staring into Chaos. It's a very scholarly book. It's easy reading, but what it does is simply takes the nuggets of information from these great philosophers, and of course the average person doesn't have the time to spend the months and months and years that Bruce has putting all this together, but you could of course get it crystallized in a concise and very, very readable form. It's an enjoyable book to read, and I certainly enjoyed it. And if you'd like to know how to get it, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, the book, Staring into Chaos. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, don't be bashful. Our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, Bruce, as you, I'm sure, you do many, many radio programs, what sort of response do you get from your listeners when you talk to them about this and what's going on, and what you found actually studying and recording the writings of these great philosophers really of the past century?
When I went into this study, I was rather pessimistic myself. I remember that Claire Booth Luce, who was the wife of the owner of Time magazine, said that all journalists are pessimists because they're realists. And perhaps traveling around the world and seeing some of the bad things I saw, I was quite pessimistic. And when I went into this study, I felt that way, and when I came out of it, I personally felt quite optimistic. I'll get to your question in just a moment, but I felt quite optimistic because I saw that regardless of the way the society goes, I don't have to go with it. I can pick and choose, sort of like living in a cannibal kingdom where you don't follow all their customs, but only some. And I can govern my own life and rise out of this. And I don't have to lie. I don't have to cheat and greed and do all the dreadful things some of which I used to do and which many people are bringing down our culture by doing. I don't have to do this. I can rise out. And it does work. It's a little expensive at times, getting out, but it's well worth it. But I wrote this book essentially for the social dropouts back in the 70s, and it took me a long time to complete it. And I wanted to help these people who I had sympathy with, the hippie types, so the conscientious dropouts, to help them see what the malaise they were feeling was. And this book, I wish I had had the presence of mind to send it to Timothy McVeigh, because it would have straightened things out for him, that he misidentified the enemy. I mean, here was a man who had a reputation for bravery and courage and thought he was doing the right thing, but he thought the enemy was the government, and it's not. It's the whole civilization or culture. But anyway, to get to your question after that background, I was expecting to get a lot of flack from this book, a lot of criticism, and irate responses, and I haven't had one single negative response. All the time the book has been out, I get long, thoughtful letters from people. I've had a very good response, and since the dropouts are gone, they're all in the computer industry or in the stock market, that group of people don't exist anymore. It's the conservatives and the Christians that have picked up on their book, which I find rather gratifying and surprising at the same time. And they do respond very favorably.
Well, I think that, of course, you bring out the message, several times, the necessity for a spiritual belief, for without that, of course, life has no meaning. And, of course, I picked that up, very early on in the book and recognized that you were coming from a believing point of view. So, of course, that's probably one reason why the Christians who've read the book appreciate it, because I think that most people who've thought about what's going on today realize that we're not going to be able to change things. If God's going to change, it's going to change. If he's not going to change it, it's not going to change. But as you say, we don't have to become part of the corruption that's there. And our job is to protect our families and our children from, as much as we can, the effects and this degradation of society and degradation of humanity. And as somebody once said, even in a prison, you can really be free. It's what's in your heart that's important, not your physical surroundings.
Sure, sure. The Indian leader Gandhi, who was living in the time of communism and capitalism and all these isms that were being promoted, made a wry statement. He said, "Someday someone will invent a system so perfect that nobody will have to be good." And of course, he was saying just the opposite, that systems will not do it. We can't rely upon systems. We really, our first task is to get to our own feet. To become well by living honest and virtuous and noble and holy lives. And Chesterton, the English writer, was one time asked what was wrong with the world, and he responded, "I am." And really, that's where it begins.
Well, of course, Chesterton had a wonderful presence, a wonderful understanding of what the world is really all about, as with any great philosopher, modern-day philosopher. Well, our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, this is an easy book to read, and yet, of course, the subject is very, very provocative. It makes you stop and think and contemplate and wonder, of course, where are we going as a society? And, of course, our job is to try to make people think. To try to make them understand that the so-called permanence that we have, I think the average individual doesn't want to hear anything bad. He wants to think everything's just fine. And yet it really isn't bad. It isn't fine. Certainly one only has to see what's happening on television, see what's happening to our youth, see what's happening. We live in an area adjacent to Salinas. My goodness, they have gang shootings there almost on a daily basis. Certainly over down in Los Angeles, in areas where we have large migrant populations, people who do not have the same cultural values or have the same respect for law or human life. We're beginning to see increasing chaos. In fact, I think this is something that our government leaders are extremely concerned about, and maybe one reason why they're doing some of the things they are, because they sense the society is breaking down. Do you have that feeling that some people, certainly in government, are aware of this progressive degeneration of society? I mean, at one time, you might have a murder in a community every couple of years, and now they're coming increasing, at least in my view, increasingly commonplace.
Well, yes, of course, yes. I'm sure that the national leaders are keenly aware. I don't know if they're aware of the long-range view behind it. And, of course, the book I'm offering, Study Into Chaos, is the biggest picture of all, and which, if you get that biggest picture, you can understand not only what's happening now, but what's going to happen next. You know, but I don't know that the government leaders think in those terms, because politicians usually think in shorter term. But they certainly are worried. There's no question about that.
Somebody once said that they're not dedicated to the right or the left; they're just dedicated to staying in office. Well, let's go to Ed, who's calling in from Aptos. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I wanted to ask.
Go ahead, Ed. I hope your cell phone isn't going dead. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Ed, we're not hearing anything. Ed, are you there? I think we either lost Ed or his cell phone has gone dead. Ed, are you there or not? All right. I'll try to call back. If you get that phone charged up or get a better line, please do. And again, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we're talking this evening with Bruce Brander about his book, Staring into Chaos. And, of course, it's simply a summary of what's happened to other civilizations and the similarity between what's happening in America and, of course, what is happening in other nations. And one of the questions that I had posed, and I wonder if many of you are concerned about it, is what part war has played in changing civilization. And of course, the response was that wars speed up this degenerative process. Well, let's see who we've got back. Ed, do we have you back?
Yeah.
Okay, Ed, did you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. The author, I want to. Sounds interesting. What do you thought about one world government as maybe being a killer?
The question is a one world government a solution to the problem? Is that the question? All right, fine. You're going to have to get that telephone fixed. Thanks so much. You can listen on the air when we... Can you listen on the air? Okay, fine. The question that is raised by our caller is, what about a one-world government? It seems that there is an increased movement towards one-world government, as if some of our leaders feel that that is a solution to the problems that that are being created today. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's quite a fascinating thing in the fascinating question in the sense that all these major social thinkers saw a one-world government in the cards for us in the relatively near future, and this is a common pattern in disintegrating cultures. For what reason, I have no idea, but there be a one-world government that is their world. In the case of Rome, it wasn't the whole world, of course, but it was their world. And the same in ancient China and India and what all, Aztec, Inca empires. Their world was all drawn together into a single governable body, and all these social philosophers do predict this for Western civilization. Not necessarily for the African countries or the Asian countries, but for Western civilization, they do predict a one world government, and it probably would draw in the other nations of the world, the other cultures, simply because Western culture is such an all-encompassing culture surrounding the earth and influencing everybody. But yeah, they all saw one world government, and Toynbee made so bold as to predict it would happen by the year 2000, and of course he was off there. But they all do see a case for that happening, yes.
Well, perhaps not as far off as we might think. Certainly this meeting that's being held in Johannesburg today may well foretell or foreshadow this one world government. We've got Dan calling in from Spokane. Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Just great. Thank you for taking my call. And this is a fascinating program. And this is something I've always wondered about. Is when societies fall, and you said that there have been 10 in the last century that have fell.
Ten through the years, not the last century.
I referred to 10 empires.
10 empires.
In the last
century. Okay, excuse me, 10 empires. Do they seem, you studied this, do they seem to be led into a fall, or does it seem to occur just spontaneously? Does it arise from the masses, or does it come from the top? What do you think?
I won't answer that from my own standpoint because I'll rely upon the people that I have, these wonderful scholars that fed me the information that I condensed. But they believe that there's a major group of leaders that is a small group, the dominant minority is what Toynbee calls them, but they are major in the sense that they do shape what's happening and everybody else tends to follow. And that's how things go.
And this is independent from these other groups. It seems to occur almost naturally and independently from these other groups.
Well, it does. And Spengler would have said it was inevitable, that societies rise and fall just like people live and die. You know, but other people argue that a lot, that it's not inevitable. And Toynbee did not believe that this is inevitable. He thought that we could rise again if Christianity finds its roots, Christianity is being the core religion of our culture, the core ethic, that if it finds its roots, if it rediscovers its essences, and they're not in going to church and singing songs, but in a way of life, then he thought that the culture could rise again. And Sorokin, who is a Harvard sociologist, believed much the same thing, that it could rise again and might, very well might.
Okay, it just takes a different group of leaders.
If they could get, and the leaders don't have to come from the people sitting in the capital buildings, the parliaments. They can, like Jesus Christ was a leader, and Confucius was a leader, and Buddha was a leader. They can come from the lower elements of society, but nonetheless they have to be leaders. And if we did get spiritual leaders who really knew what spiritual was about, who really knew who had discernment for the rules of life, as it were, and by rules I mean, what life needs to be strong and healthy, human life, and what we need to form good, strong, healthy communities. If a leader like that could arise, and Confucius was one, and Jesus, of course, was a supreme one, then, of course, we could rise again.
But, of course, can we do it without changing the hearts of men? Isn't really, even if we had a leader like that, and we had people who, of course, were decadent, would society change? Don't we have to start with the individual rather than with the leader?
We sure do. We sure do. And leaders often will help, but you and I can be leaders of ourselves in that sense, and we'll perhaps influence other people. And in small ways, we can be the seeds of the new spiritual culture, in small ways, mm-hmm. whether a great leader arises or not.
Well said. Dan, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No, that was a great answer, and I'm glad you said that. And this is a wonderful program. I'm going to hang up and listen then.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
And I hope you're going to get everybody up there in the state of Washington and Oregon and Western Idaho listening to us. Thanks so much. And incidentally, for our leaders, for our listeners up there, we are doing a program every Saturday morning on the American Christian Network at 10 o'clock in the morning. And so we certainly encourage people to listen, to get their friends to listen. And, of course, this is how we build up a listening audience, a loyal listening audience, and we can continue doing that program. So remember, it's 10 o'clock in the morning on the American Christian Network in the Washington, Northern Oregon, Western Idaho, and, of course, we're on the big 810 station out of Spokane, five stations up there. We blanket most of the state of Washington outside the Olympic Peninsula in Seattle. And so please encourage your friends and your relatives and even people on the streets. Just tell them about our 10 o'clock program. And also tell them about our evening program. We need to get people listening. We need to get them educated. We need to get them reading. We need to get them to begin to reorient their thought to realize that if America is to be saved, it's going to have to start with changing the hearts of people and bringing them back to a personal relationship with our Lord. Because, of course, as it's been said, man cannot live without God. And all I can say is we've been trying to do it, and we're not doing a very good job today in America. Well, our guest this evening is Bruce Brander. His book, Staring into Chaos, if you'd like more information, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARN. If you want to call us, of course, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Bruce, now, certainly we're going to have to see a spiritual awakening in the populace. But my concern right now, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this at all, but it looks like we are intent upon going to war in the Middle East. And, of course, you've been around the world. You've seen, I'm sure, many wars. In fact, one of the pictures in the back of the book there shows you standing in front of a truck with a, it looks like sort of a, is that an anti-aircraft gun? It's one of the biggest guns I ever saw.
It's one of the Mad Max vehicles in Somalia.
Oh boy. Were you over there during that debacle?
I was there before the Marines landed, yes, and during the Marines landing, and it was really quite a sight. It was an extraordinary thing.
All right, fine. Well, we got Bill calling in from Coeur d'Alene, and so if you'll just transfer Bill over to us. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Two quick points. One was, do you have an opinion on the new fellow that has become the Archbishop of Canterbury, and also the fact that in South Africa we're getting ready to, not we, but the UN and its members are getting ready to sign the New Ages version of the new Ten Commandments.
Which, you mean the Earth Charter? Well,
the Earth Charter.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Bruce?
Not a whole lot, Dr. Stan. I am up on the news usually, and I have not been reading the Economist for the past few weeks, I'm sorry to say. And the studies I've been doing, and I'm working on a different one now, are these big, big, big picture things, and I don't get into the immediacies, and unless I'm reading the Economist weekly, and I have left that goal for a little while. So I really couldn't say a whole lot about that.
Well, all I can say is, Bill, I'm very, very concerned about the outcome of the what's going on in South Africa. This is the culmination of a 30-year effort, beginning with the First Earth Summit in 1972, headed by Maurice Strong. And I would simply say that these people have a different vision of the world than you and I do. And it's represented in the writings of the Club of Rome, The Limits of Growth, a book that came out in 1971 and 1972. And if you read that book, I think you'll understand where they're going. And, of course, I am very concerned about this idea of a new charter for the world that, of course, removes the benefits of Christianity and substitutes the religion of paganism or pantheism, which just seems to be what they're advocating. So, I hope that answers your question.
Yes, Dr. Stan, thank you.
God, bye-bye. And let's go to Rob calling from Spokane. Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Hey, Dr. Stan. And my question is, to what extent is Islam affected by the same things that, you know, Christendom has been affected, like hedonism and materialism? Seems like they've been more resistant to that than Christianity has been.
All right. Did you get the question? What about the Islamic nations? Are they falling into hedonism as we are, or are they simply more isolated because of the strictness of the clerics who seem to more or less control the Islamic faith?
Well, sir, I have spent quite a lot of time in the Middle East. I wrote a book on the River Nile and based myself in Cairo at that time, and I've covered the Palestine-Israel problems on occasionally from the Arabic side. And the best I could say, to the greatest extent of my observations, and I had many Arabic friends who showed me around over there, these countries are trying, their religious leaders are trying to instill an old-fashioned type of Islam, the Sharia Islamic law, which was medieval, and they're trying to sort of go backward to the old times, which were the great times of Islam in the 1300s, 1400s. And it's not working, of course, because Western culture has gotten into their culture for good and for ill. I mean, they have our medicine, our wonderful medical techniques. They have our science and technology. They drive around our inventions, our automobiles and motorcycles. So they have all these things that also, getting into their culture, is the lesser elements of ours, these dirty mouth movies and all this sort of thing. And that's what they are objecting against. People like the extremists are saying that we are imposing cultural and economic imperialism upon them, which is not fully true because they're accepting it. They're inviting it in. But they would like to go back to old-fashioned Islam, and it's not going to work. You can't go back to anything, just like we can't go back to Victorian days. And it's a real dead-end situation for them. And that's about all I can say about that, that they're striving to do that, and they're crashing planes into our buildings to try to get our culture out of theirs, and it's not going to work. They really should be trying to clean up their own act.
No, I think that's probably a very good response. And I'm very, very concerned about this Wahhabi religion. You know, encourages people to die for Allah, and the only way you can get into paradise is to be killed in battle. This is sort of fanaticism. It really can begin to disrupt the entire structure of our society and the world. And certainly, it's not the way the average Muslim feels. The average Muslim doesn't want to live this way. I mean, he has his beliefs, but he doesn't want this radical form of Islam, which is they're trying to introduce. And certainly is being funded by the Saudis and by the Pakistani. And, of course, what most people don't understand is that during the Afghan War, we promoted this form of radical Islam, which I think is, of course, unconscionable. And those of you who haven't read my newsletter going into how we actually provided the textbooks, $56 million for textbooks to promote this, or even on CBS, some of this was covered last night in 60 Minutes. You really need to get the script from CBS last night to find out how we promoted radical Islam. Hey, we're out of time. Thanks so much for calling, Rob.
Thank you.
And Bruce, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. And again, the book is Staring into Chaos. If you'd like to get more information, why, of course, you can call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But I've really appreciated having you with us.
Well, it's my great pleasure, Doctor.
Bye-bye, and God bless you, sir. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Okay, fine. That was Bruce Brander, Staring into Chaos. I hope you enjoyed the program. Now we have to bid adieu to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest. And for those of you who will continue listening the next hour, we're going to have with us Joel Skousen. So it should be an interesting time, and we'll be back here in just about 2 minutes with the second hour of Radio Liberty. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we are welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us Joel Skousen. Joel hasn't been available for some weeks. We've certainly missed having him on, but his latest newsletter comes out, a World Affairs Brief, and pointing out what's happening as far as missiles are concerned. You know, we're so concerned because, of course, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. That's WMD. I love how they make these initials, you know, to give this meaning. WMD means weapons of mass destruction, if you didn't already know. But, of course, Saddam Hussein may have some missiles. No question, I'm sure he has. But then so do so many other countries throughout the world. And the number of nations with missiles is growing and growing rapidly. And, of course, the efforts to obtain thermonuclear devices or nuclear weapons, or certainly the poor man's weapons, which are biological and chemical warfare, because, of course, this is how you defend yourself against another overwhelming power, and that overwhelming power in the world today is the United States. So, Joel, thank you so much for being with us, and why don't you just pick up your thoughts, so beautifully done, in your latest World Affairs Brief.
Well, thank you, Stan. It is nice to be back with you again. Been out of state and apologize for not being available to be with you and your audience, but the issue that I'm discussing this week in my World Affairs Brief, which I've entitled The Realities of Missile Proliferation, The Key to a Future War, is just as you've outlined in your introduction. In other words, there's something very wrong with the picture that we are focusing our attention, at least through the Bush administration eyes, and Vice President Cheney's speech yesterday, again, beating the drums that Iraq is a great and dangerous problem. Something very wrong with this picture when there are tens of other nations that have hundreds and thousands more missiles and more weapons of mass destruction than Iraq, and somehow Iraq is the only threat that we have to be concerned about, so concerned that we have to be going to war over it, and yet there is virtually not only no sentiment for war against the other powers who literally have hundreds of missiles dedicated and aimed at the United States. Saddam Hussein's Scuds can't even get outside the Middle East, let alone touch any American, and yet somehow Saddam Hussein is the enemy. There's something very wrong with this picture, especially since those in the administration who are making this case know very, very well that the enemies that really confront us are other than Iraq.
And I think one of the big things that nobody talks about Iran, and yet Iran is really one of the most powerful countries, closely aligned with Russia, that is funding and helping Iran build up their nuclear potential, and of course China. All of these countries have a tremendous supply. So both India and Pakistan have a tremendous fair number of missiles, and certainly with nuclear warheads. But of course, we're not going to go to war with them, are we? Or maybe we should go to war with everybody who has weapons of mass destruction. My feeling, Joel, is that this war is being fought for far different purposes than the men who will be sent there to fight and bleed and suffer and die will ever be told.
Well, there are secret and ulterior motives and agendas involved, which explains the conundrums that I point out in my briefs, that these people are not stupid. These people are able to see the same things and even more than what I see. They have access to real live intelligence data, but I make the case in my brief that they are suppressing that data. They're making sure that the American people don't know where the real threats lie, and they are conjuring up relatively minor threats in order to engender conflict. And this is my main hypothesis, is that the war in Iraq is going to be a trigger event for a much larger type of conflict that will end up being a worldwide conflict, in my opinion.
Well, of course, that is really my fear, that when you start a war, you never know how it's going to end. And the history of the First World War, it started with the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, and it ended up with the fall of the Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Turkish Empire. It destroyed the world at that time. And of course, if we get into a war over there, is Saudi Arabia next on the line? Is Iran next on the line? How far are we willing to go to take on other countries that are dominant in the field, in the oil situation?
Well, there is some indication that the United States is preparing to attack more than just Iraq. I outlined in the week prior to that how they're starting to put out negative leaks concerning Saudi Arabia, and they're allowing a great deal of anti-Saudi press to arise. This class action suit from victims of 9/11 trying to sue Saudi Arabia for trillions of dollars is really being promoted in order to justify eventually intervening in Saudi Arabia. This week they started to attack Egypt. And they had to do this in a sleight-of-hand method. On one hand, the diplomats continue to laud the great friendship we have with Saudi Arabia and with Egypt. And on the other hand, they start to talk about cutoff of aid and support of terrorism and other things that put them on the enemy list. So much of this is an attempt by the administration to twist arms and to get these people into a compliant condition, and that is in terms of a globalist agenda. But more and more we're seeing the case that no one trusts what the American government says anymore. When the Saudi Arabians don't believe it, when the government lauds them as friends, they know they're attempting to destroy them, so they're intending to betray the United States as well. And I can't help but think that the people in charge of policy in Washington know that that's exactly what's happening, and they are, in fact, festering the Arab Empire, intervening and making sure that they create a great enemy, an enemy that will join forces eventually with the Russian-Chinese combination, which still is a great predator faction intending to take the control of the world and to destroy the West in some future war.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, you mentioned that so many countries have missiles. Do you want to just sort of develop that idea?
Yes, it's important for people to understand that in comparison with Iraq, even the neighbors surrounding Iraq have many more missiles and biological and chemical and even nuclear warhead systems far in excess of what Iraq has. Now, we know Iraq has biological and chemical weapons because the United States provided the equipment and the European allies provided much of the materiel to use that equipment, even after the United States stopped sending things directly to Iraq after the Gulf War. But despite Iraq's puny, you know, perhaps a dozen Scud inaccurate missiles they have there, you compare that to Iran next door, as you pointed out in your introduction. Iran has hundreds of missiles, including intermediate and even developing the Shihab 4 long-range ballistic missile capable of hitting Europe. And they're doing this obviously for deterrence so that they can mount a massive attack upon Israel in the next Middle East war and keep the United States and Europe from intervening. Syria, for example, has over 600 missiles. Now compare that to a dozen of the most rudimentary Scuds that Iraq has. Syria has known quantities of biological and chemical warheads and is developing the techniques, of course, of sending those to Israel on their missile supplies. They have cruise missiles as well. Libya and Egypt also have large stocks in the hundreds of missiles. These four or five nations in combination can mass together almost 2,000 missiles to send over in the next war against Israel, and they're clearly intending to fight a missile war as the great equalizer. Americans are all consumed with the great technological superiority of the United States in terms of conventional weapons, but they don't really understand. After years of propaganda, having been told that no one would dare use nuclear weapons or missiles, is absolutely untrue. The entire rest of the world is stockpiling and building missiles. And the only reason they're doing so is that's their only counter-defense against an interventionist United States that is more and more making itself enemies around the world, giving itself a bullying image. Because despite what the American people are being told, the Americans are not intervening in behalf of democracy. They're not intervening in behalf of a war against terrorism. Because they foment terrorism, they arm terrorists, they send supplies to the terrorists in Iran, in Ireland, they send supplies to the Middle Eastern terrorists. Even clear back in the Reagan administration, they armed the Iranians. And so there is an ulterior motive, and that motive, I believe, is to create a war that would bring apart, bring about a new world order and a globalist government.
And I think that anybody who doubts what Joel is saying, I was just been preparing for a talk. You know, and of course, we in Kosovo were backing the Al Qaeda forces. They were the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army. That was Al Qaeda. They were drug smugglers. They were terrorists. And we backed them there against the Serbians.
And trained them by the CIA.
Right, and of course the same thing is true in Bosnia. In fact, according to Josip Podansky in his wonderful book, Osama bin Laden, or Bin Laden, the man who declared war against America, he talks about how Zuhari, who heads the whole world terrorist movement, had planned the attack on the American forces, Black Hawk Down ambush, had been instrumental in all of the major terrorist attacks. And yet the CIA is operating with him and contacting and working with him in 1997, after they've taken down the Khobar Towers, after they certainly were involved in the bombing of our TW-800. They even bragged about it in Europe, and yet that information was suppressed in the United States, and yet our CIA is working with al-Zuhari. What's wrong with his picture? He was allowed to come and tour the United States in 1995 and actually establish terrorist cells here at that time and raise funds for international terrorism. Articles in the New York Times. We have all of this documentation. Why have we consistently financed the terrorists? Why was it that during the when we started the war in Afghanistan, our commanders were given orders not to try to get Osama bin Laden? We've got the articles out of the Washington Times where high officials said our policy is not Osama bin Laden first but last. And then, of course, in November, when we're the battle is heated up, suddenly we call a ceasefire so the Pakistanis can get their people out. And planes land and take out a lot of the al-Qaeda in this mid-December. There's an article in the latest U.S. News and World Report talking about the Afghans are pursuing the al-Qaeda, 1,000 al-Qaeda leaders. And, of course, what happens in the middle of the battle? In come a fleet of black helicopters and scoop up the al-Qaeda. Our government said, those were us. We were dropping off and picking up special forces. Well, the Afghans working there didn't know anything about any special forces. They didn't see any special forces there helping them, but they know that somebody in those helicopters whisked away al-Qaeda. That is in the latest August 19th U.S. News and World Report. Get it and read it and ask yourself, why would we send in black helicopters to rescue al-Qaeda? And maybe things are not as they would appear to be.
Well, I'm convinced, Stan, that al-Qaeda is a U.S. creation.
Well, I don't think everybody has ever studied it knows we financed it when it began back in 1988.
Yeah, and I don't think it ever stopped, though. I think that, you know, U.S. claims that we lost control of it, that it became hostile and turned against, but I don't think there's really any evidence of that, because virtually all of, you know, you'd never heard of al-Qaeda before the 9/11. And suddenly, it's this massive terrorist organization that's infiltrated the whole world, and yet you never heard of it before.
Right.
In other words, they never claimed responsibility for any attacks. The United States claimed to be fighting Osama bin Laden, but they never did attempt to capture him when he was delivered to them or offered to be delivered to them by several different governments. And to this day, I have contacts in the government that have indicated that they've had Pakistanis come, fly to the United States, get special audiences with high Pentagon officials to explain to them exactly where Osama bin Laden was, and the government says, we're not interested. They don't follow up. They will not capture Osama bin Laden. They do not want this icon of terrorism captured, lest the American people lose interest in this ongoing phony war on terrorism.
We know that in 1996, the government of Sudan offered to turn him over to Saudi Arabia, and they've been sent back and would have been beheaded. We know in 1997, the Taliban offered to turn him over to the Saudis. The Saudis wouldn't take him. We know that Dana Rohrabacher, congressman, I heard him talking about how he knew exactly where bin Laden was. He went to the Clinton administration. They refused to do anything. In 1999, there was a training commandos in Pakistan to take him out. There was a revolt there, and they just canceled the whole thing. We were watching him regularly. We had people on the ground watching him. We had the Predator airplanes watching him, and we just never did anything to Osama bin Laden. Why wouldn't we if he was really responsible for the bombing of the Khobar Towers in Riyadh and the embassies and the bombing of the coal? Why wouldn't we go in and take out Osama bin Laden unless, of course, he was playing a very significant part in some other agenda? Would that be a fair statement?
Well, it is. And, you know, the United States has become an expert in playing both sides of the spectrum. You know, they pretend to fight a war on terror, they fight a war on drugs, they fight a war against illegal immigration, while at the same time they run the largest pipeline of drug importation through the CIA into the United States. They purposely foment and allow hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens, but only those of Latino and Muslim extraction, to come into the United States. They hold an absolute 100% tight net against any white Caucasian immigrants from countries that are, you know, not of the Latino Muslim. In other words, there is a multicultural political agenda to undermine the United States culture through this immigration. That's why, despite the abject failures of amnesty during the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, without any impulse from Congress whatsoever, is demanding another amnesty, but of course only for Latino aliens here, and that indicates that there is this hidden multicultural agenda. There are agendas about this war in Iraq, and I can only conclude that terrorism is being used as the excuse to foment additional wars of intervention. Certainly Afghanistan was not an appropriate target for Al-Qaeda. They've never rounded up more than 100 or 200 supposedly Al-Qaeda representatives there, and that certainly doesn't justify the kind of intervention that went on there. You know, where was Al-Qaeda? If you believe U.S. propaganda, Al-Qaeda was in thousands of cells within the United States and in Europe, and yet there have been no terrorist attacks from Al-Qaeda in Europe. There have been no terrorist attacks from Al-Qaeda in the United States other than the supposed 9/11. And this defies all definition of what happens in terrorism. If Al-Qaeda is being attacked at its very core in Afghanistan, assuming that the U.S. position is true, then why are not there cadres in the United States attacking? Why is there no terrorism? Why no suicide bombers? Why no car bombs? The simplest thing to do, there's no way to protect against car bombs. You just load it up, set it off by remote telephone call. There's been nothing in the United States. That means there have been no terrorist cells. Or if they are here, they are controlled by the very government that is claiming to protect us. Because there's no other reason to explain why they would not be attacking when they are under such vociferous attack from the U.S. in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, this is really a very, very provocative and important question. And I don't believe that there are Al-Qaeda terrorist cells here, but I believe there are terrorist cells. There's a fascinating book that was written by Joseph Badansky, who's the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, published back in 1993. And that book was suppressed. You cannot get, I've been unable to get a copy anywhere in the United States. I had to have our agent go over to England to get a copy of the book as published in England, but you just couldn't get one here. And I've already talked about the Gulf War and the fact that there were actually a number of Iranian and Syrian terrorist cells, the sleepers that we've been bringing in under our multicultural program. And they, of course, Saddam was anticipating using them during the Gulf War. And that's why I was talking about the mother of all wars and, you know, all this grandiose bragging he had. And then at the last minute, You know, when America is going to attack him and he gives the order for the uprising in America and Iran and Syria, supposedly our great enemies say, sorry, Saddam, we're not going to help you. And the terror cells we control are not going to do anything. And nothing happened in America. Is Budansky right? I've got a gut feeling that there are terrorist cells here, but they were under very strict and tight control. And the question is, why haven't they done anything? And remember, of course, during that time, we gave $1 billion to Assad of Syria. And, of course, who was it who brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in Iran? Everybody's forgotten. February of 1979, the United States government toppled the government of the Shah and brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power. We never talk about that.
Well, and there were a lot of secret negotiations for arms, especially during the Iran hostage crisis.
Right.
We know that the Reagan-Bush administration traded lots of arms for to make sure that the prisoners weren't released during the Carter administration so as to foment a Republican return to office there. George Bush was the main instrument there. I know Reagan was aware of it, but he was pretty well kept in the dark of the actual arms transfers going on.
In fact, it was so interesting, almost like somebody had scripted it. It was on the morning that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as president that it was announced that the American prisoners would be released by Iran. Wasn't that a coincidence?
Well, as we know, it's not a coincidence. But, the American people aren't told these kinds of stories. That operation called October Surprise has been well documented by whistleblowers, one of which flew George Bush back in a YF-12A, the predecessor of the SR-71, in order to get him back in time to have plausible deniability that he never went to Paris to sign this secret agreement with Iran about trading arms for delay of hostage release. And the United States, covers up these kinds of operations. You have tremendous documentaries come out trying to discredit these whistleblowers to make sure the American people do not believe the dark side activities that our government has been involved in for so many years.
Well, the Stoll story is so incredible that, if I hadn't studied it, and I have just piles of books written, long before 9/11 that tell you this whole story, and you put them all together, and you realize that the American CIA and intelligence has been covering for, helping, and supporting, and really protecting the Islamic terrorist movement and Osama bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, his right-hand man. And, of course, the only question is, how could it be with all the technology we have, we just can't find Osama bin Laden? Were you suggesting that since the war ended over there, that that some people have actually been coming and offering to tell our forces where he is?
Yes. I got a call from a former Reagan administration official telling me that he was, in fact, the one who had been contacted by these Pakistanis. They weren't getting any help from the Pakistani government. They were naive enough to think that the U.S. really did want to find Osama bin Laden.
Well, after all, we're offering $25 million, and we must really want him.
They were interested in the reward, but in any case, they had absolute information. They had been with him in a camp. They had seen him not more than less than a week before. They had absolute sure information of where he was, and my friend who called me said, I personally arranged for him to get an audience with top deputy defense officials under Rumsfeld, and they had the meeting, and he was going to let me know what came of the meeting. And later on he called me and said, you just won't believe it. Of course, I said, sure I will. I said, they didn't want to hear from him. That's right. He said they did not want to hear the information. They listened to him. They made no commitments about doing anything. They just said thank you very much and dismissed them. And nothing has happened.
I guess they don't win the jackpot then, do they? The
$25 million
dollar sweet.
They don't win the jackpot, but there's something wrong with this entire picture. And, of course, this stuff doesn't get out to the American people. The only people who hear this kind of information are people who read my briefs or listen to your fine radio shows, Dr. Stan, and I wish that that audience was larger.
Well, so do I, but it's growing out there, and more people are listening, certainly on the Internet and to our radio program. So I'm not in the least bit discouraged. At least we have a voice. We have more of a chance to get the truth out now than ever before, you know, in the 40 years I've been in this battle. So I'm guardedly optimistic.
Well, I wish people would realize, though, Stan, that this is the heyday of our opening, and that when you look at what Ashcroft and the Bush administration is doing to formulate this powerful Homeland Security Agency, which has tremendous Gestapo-like powers to shut down the opposition, and they're talking openly of detention camps for enemy dissidents and people who aid and abet in terrorism, and I'm afraid that someday we're going to look back with nostalgia and say, remember the days when we could speak openly about these things. The day will come, I'm telling you, and I think you realize, Dr. Stan, that we'll be viewed as enemies of the people for criticizing government when this war gets very, very big, and we start to blow the whistle and say, we told you so. This was a phony war. This was conjured up in order to justify what's happening today, and we'll be silenced.
Well, you may well be right. I fear that you probably are. But, you know, if you look at it logically, I mean, here we have, 15 Saudi citizens come to America with visas, and they attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now,
with multiple visas, multiple times.
Right. And there are no, there are no Taliban involved. There's nobody from Afghanistan involved in this at all. In fact, the Afghan said, we'll give you Osama bin Laden if you show us the evidence against him that he was involved, or we'll turn Osama bin Laden over to a third country, and they can try him, or we'll just ask him to leave our country. There was no way that we were going to accept any of those offers.
Negotiate with them.
Right. We just said we're going to war, and the American people don't understand that. And yet, of course, all the evidence suggests that we rescued the Al-Qaeda and prevented them from being destroyed. And so what's wrong with this picture? And those of you who have not read the latest U.S. News and World Report, August 19th, read that article about the how Al-Qaeda escaped. And ask yourself, do you really think that Osama bin Laden has a fleet of black helicopters? Does anybody honestly believe that? You read enough the media, occasionally you'll get the truth. Not very often, but occasionally you'll get it.
Yeah, they will. They do tell the truth quite often, but they know now that all they have to do is mention it once, then they can say we're covered, we told that story.
Right.
But they know that if they don't make a drumbeat of it, if they don't repeat it multiple times, the American people won't ever notice, no one else will pick up the story, and it simply dies.
Right. Well, fortunately, we're getting more and more information, and there's so much evidence they had prior knowledge. The officials in the Pentagon canceling their flights for September 11th on September the 10th. Now, that is Newsweek magazine, September 24th of last year. Of course, the story of Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco, Simon Rusty being told on the 3rd of September not to fly on American or Canadian airliners without special precautions. There is no question at all that they knew the attack was coming. They knew where the attack was coming because, of course, no planes were put in the air that morning. There is no way you could have done that unintentionally. And the fact that, it's really so interesting that Dick Cheney, is making this big fuss about the leak from the Senate Intelligence Committee. He wants to give lie detector tests to the senators. He wants all of their records, who might have been talking to the media. And, of course, what was the leak? Why, they'd gotten some information the day before, but they hadn't bothered to decipher it. It was in Arabic, and so they couldn't understand it was until the 12th. But the fact that somebody let that out, they had that information, and they knew what it was. Now, but, of course, what they're doing is trying to distract our attention from the very obvious, and that is there was prior knowledge. And so the issue is not, why did they not do something when they knew there was going to be an attack and it was going to involve airliners and it was going to involve the World Trade Center. And instead of that, they're distracting our attention by pointing at the senators or the member of the committee. Do you think they're playing games with our minds?
There's a pattern emerging here that's very important for people to understand, and I'm one of those who goes further than simple prior knowledge. Do we have to take a break here?
I'm afraid we do, but when
we'll take that up afterwards.
We got a three-minute break, and if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 1-866-464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us across America, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We need your help to continue doing what we're doing, getting the information out across America. But, of course, if you believe that there's a problem, if you believe that America is worthwhile sacrificing for, if you believe that we have an obligation to pass on the torch of liberty that we inherited from generations past to generations yet unborn, then give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family, or that you'll subscribe to the newsletter, or if you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, we'll be glad to send you one at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope that you'll tell others about our radio programs, that you'll tell them about our website, which is radioliberty.com, where you can actually pull down many of our programs that are archived there. You can listen to us live 5 hours a day. But the most important thing is to get as many people as possible listening. Now, most people don't want to hear the truth. Most people would rather be ignorant and stupid. And so I simply say to them, well, if you're not concerned about what's happening, how do you feel about your boy being drafted to go over to fight in a war in the Middle East? How would you feel about provoking a nuclear attack on America? How would you feel to see our cities in ashes, or the threat of a biological attack here, and they're beginning to round up people and send them to detention camps? Those camps are being prepared for here in America, and they're being declared for people who question what our government is doing. In fact, the president said that we will not tolerate any conspiracy theories. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. Well, I think there are a lot of people who love America who are not with the administration and certainly oppose the terrorists. But, of course, we are told that we only have two choices. We're either with the administration, we support their policies, or we're with the terrorists. Can freedom be lost? Freedom is lost when good people do nothing. And you have a chance to be part of our program, part of our effort. We hope many of you will decide right now you're going to become part of the Radio Liberty family. And if, as I say, if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America is going headlong into a senseless war over in Iraq against an enemy that we financed, an enemy that we kept in power in 1991 when we could have easily removed the wicked Saddam Hussein. And now we're going to send our boys over to fight and bleed and suffer and die to destroy the very enemy that we created. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. And Joel, do you want to pick up the thought that you had just before I so rudely interrupted you?
Well, I was going to explain what I view is the linkage between the U.S. globalist agenda in creating war and conflict, and this, and how they create terrorism through third-party intermediaries. It's very important what I mentioned earlier in the program about the fact that there are numerous terrorist cells in the United States. And the United States government has them in all their computers, and they're tracking them. And yet they never attack. Now, certainly we know that the people in the Middle East have the hatred, they have the means, they have the materiel, we have the wide open borders, we have the lack of security. For example, even in Israel, when they have 100 times more security and checks against terrorism, terrorism is a daily and weekly issue there, even with that heightened security. So we know that there is no logical reason why there shouldn't be daily and weekly acts of terrorism here. Now, the only conclusion I can come to is that the people are here, they're not attacking. That means they're under control. They've got orders not to attack.
Right, I agree with you totally.
Someone's controlling them. We also know, for example, that in every one of the major so-called domestic terrorist events, whether it was Oklahoma City or the first World Trade Center bombing, there were Middle Easterners, the John Does, the unidentified people that were involved in those attacks. Each one of those Middle Easterners had prior contacts with government, both CIA and FBI, and after the attack, especially Oklahoma City bombing, the FBI protected the identity of all of those Middle Eastern contacts that McVeigh had that helped him in securing the explosives and driving the trucks and playing middleman and supplying him the expertise for these things. And they were protected by the FBI. So what I believe, and this is my theory, is that the United States with, and I'm talking about the globalist leadership, not the many wonderful good agents, military people, there are good FBI people and good CIA people, but there's an ulterior dark side in all of these agencies who do the illegal activities. And I believe that they have created an Arab Muslim middleman terrorist organization called Al-Qaeda. And Osama bin Laden has direct contact with his CIA handlers as well as some of his other top henchmen. But no one else in Al-Qaeda knows of the CIA connection. All they hear is Osama bin Laden instilling in them hatred of America, and he's doing it because he knows that there's a game plan. Only he knows that there is a that he's being paid by the CIA, he's being backed by them and being protected by them. So there are legitimate terrorists, but he gives them the orders. They are controlled terrorism, and that is the only thing that explains why suddenly they attack, why the government claims no responsibility and no knowledge. But I go beyond what you say in terms of foreknowledge. I think there's actually pre-planning of direct conflict and terrorism, bombing of American cities, and they don't care how many people they kill. I know Americans find this incomprehensible, that Americans would actually allow other Americans to be killed. But if you look back in history, if you study the history of World War II, you'll see that the Germans did that all of the time. The Russians have done that. The Russians bombed their own apartments in Moscow to blame it on the Chechens. The Germans set fire to their own Congress, the Reichstag, to blame it on the communists. They produced incidents of agent provocateurs in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, in every other country that justified their intervention. This is not a new thing. This is representative of systematic evil. There is systematic evil in this world. It inspires men to great evil acts, and the world has got to wake up to the fact that our government is not immune from that same evil, that same evil tempter who tempts people to do great evil acts in the name of gaining power and immunity from the judgments of God and other types of incentives. Work for a larger, more evil cause, and it is against Christianity, it's against our values, against God, country, and the Constitution, which we revere so much. And that's what I see as this great evil commanding a middle force that creates terrorism, that gives the United States an arm's-length relationship so that it will never get tracked to that source of terrorism. And in fact, we do have whistleblowers, C-130 pilots, who have testified that the CIA sent Stinger missiles to the IRA in 1989, in C-130s landing in Ireland. They sent arms, of course, to Iran. They sent arms to the Sandinistas. They sent arms and technology to China. And all of these things are arming our enemies because of this grand collusion to create war and conflict, which will eventually lead to a global governance which will justify the destruction of American constitutional liberties.
And I think that really what you are so right at is that there are two parallel forces in America. One is, of course, the force of good and of Christianity and of people who believe in American values. But there is another force here. It's an occult force. It is a sinister and evil force. It's personified by the secret societies like the Skull and Bones around here since 1833. And, of course, it is founded basically in the occult. And parallel organizations, many parallel organizations, and most people are totally unaware that they even exist. And the fact that they do exist and the American people don't understand simply reflects the degree of control that exists over what American people think. I know you're probably well acquainted with Operation Northwood, and this is the Joint Chiefs of Staff plan back in 1962 on how to provoke a war with Cuba. I'm sure you're well aware of that one, aren't you, Joel?
Yes.
And, of course, I mean, they were going to blow up one of the astronauts, John Glenn, when he went up, and they were going to blame the blowing up of his missile on the Cubans, or they were going to sink boats, or they were going to blow up airplanes.
That's
or
correct.
They were going to assassinate people. This was your joint chiefs of staff planning how would we provoke a war with Cuba. And, of course, the only good thing was that either McNamara or President Kennedy, I'm not sure which one, said, we're not going to do that sort of thing. That may very well have led, at least in part, to the decision to assassinate Kennedy, because somebody wanted to provoke a war with Cuba.
I'm actually, I disagree with some of that scenario, even though you've represented it correctly as it's come through the Internet. This is not how it ever happened. My view of the dark side of government, my study of this indicates that, one, they never try to get chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff involved in an open conspiracy to assassinate or kill innocent Americans. They never do that. And you never have a politician like McNamara or Kennedy opposing it. It's just the opposite, in fact. These plans are hatched among secret societies deep within government, and very rarely are ignorant yes-men military generals involved in that type of planning. That's the disinformation about what's being spread, is that they're blaming it on right-wing militarism or painting it as, when in fact those kinds of plans are the things that your secret society people, your Dean Rusk and your Atchisons and your Dulles and other people involved in OSS and dark side operations hatch up. And I think there's a little bit of disinformation twisting of this story to blame it on the military.
Well, do you think Operation Northwood is legitimate?
No, I think it's a disinformation piece that was put out to blame and make it appear as if it was right-wing militarism was going to kill its own people, and that Kennedy was innocent of that. Kennedy was, as much of a yes-man as Bill Clinton was. He was not the planner. He was not in charge of America. Kennedy was not killed because he was ever defending American values. He was a corrupted, personally, morally corrupted yes man who simply did what he was told. They simply killed him because his immorality was going to be exposed. They couldn't hardly keep the lid on it. It was so constant. They ruled that he was, in my opinion, much more valuable as a martyr, because then they could build upon the martyrdom of JFK to pass every piece of legislation that was failing in Congress, which is precisely what happened. I think that's why they killed Martin Luther King as well, because of the martyr syndrome, his womanizing, his liaison with the most corrupt elements of society and mafia and communist elements would have got him discredited. But as a martyr, they were able to sanctify the man so that he became beyond critique. So I think Operation Northwoods is a disinformation piece because it's aimed at painting the military, the normal general, as the boogeyman there, and it diverts people from the real dark side operators within government, which are still there, in fact.
All right. Do you think then that it was not actually contrived by somebody that it really never was actually a top secret classified
document? Yeah, they never intended to overthrow Cuba.
Well, certainly I don't think that they did. The question is, who wrote this, and is this being put out by the CIA to confuse people? Certainly James Manford put this out in his book Body of Secrets, and then of course it. Apparently has been somebody apparently had gotten it off of some sort of a government website. Who would have put it up there, or was it did it really come from a government website?
It never gets put up there on a government website unless it's disinformation, these types of things. I mean, the government never allows to be leaked out to these the real operations that are going on that actually have gone forward. You know, this is this, admittedly a hypothetical one that they're claiming was planned. But it has all the markings of disinformation, because it's absolving and pointing the fingers away from the real dark side elements, who I know the names of, who were operating at the same time that Kennedy was assassinated. And none of those people figure in that. They're trying to really blame this on the legitimate patriotic conservatives who wanted to rid the world of communism, saying that they would be capable of doing these kind of dastardly deeds, and that is absolutely untrue. There are untrue. There are never any examples of the patriotic, conservative, anti-communist elements within the military or the government that had any inkling that they would sacrifice human American beings in order to justify something like this. They were the type that were in favor of going directly into Kennedy and saying, no, we don't need to shoot down American airplanes. He's a communist. We have the evidence. We can go in and remove him under the Monroe Doctrine. That's how they would operate. So I suspect this information there.
All right. How do you feel about some of the operations over in Vietnam, like Operation Tailwind or Phoenix? And those two operations, for our listeners out there, Tailwind was a operation where, of course, American special forces were supposedly dropped into Laos, one, to kill American deserters, two, to test sarin gas. And, of course, Operation Phoenix was an operation by which we hired assassins to kill Vietnamese who opposed our policies in South Vietnam. Certainly, these were done by patriotic Americans who really believed that we were fighting communism. If the stories we're getting are true, do you believe that, Operation Phoenix and Operation Tailwind are accurate?
I believe that both of those operations occurred, yes. Those are historical operations of which we have whistleblowers telling about. These were not hypothetical operations. That they were all patriotic, principled people, no, I don't buy that. Operation Phoenix had, as most government operations, its white and its dark side. There was a legitimate side to it which was justified, and that is the assassination of Viet Cong leaders who were communist, who were killing people, who were ruthless. You know, those leaders should have no immunity any more than soldiers have immunity. It's perfectly legitimate to assassinate. In fact, it's more preferable to assassinate the evil leaders who are starting wars than it is to go after relatively innocent troops. But Operation Phoenix had its dark side, too, and its dark side operators who were not patriotic Americans, who killed South Vietnamese politicians who were opposed to the American presence or who knew about CIA operations who were going to blow the whistle on it. It also targeted even American POWs or American deserters who were an embarrassment to the war under certain circumstances or who knew too much. And so there were both light and dark sides. But yes, both operations existed, but they are not uniformly, you can't paint them uniformly patriotic or good. They had both their good and their bad sides.
Yes, I know some people who are involved with Phoenix who love America.
That's right.
Really thought that what they were doing was fighting communism, but then most of our people over there really thought that it was a legitimate war.
But then you have Bruce Lindsay, for example, you know, who's now been put in to the Office of Homeland Security, who's a CIA operative on the dark side of Operation Phoenix. And that's very worrisome that a person who knows how to eliminate political opposition has been put into a high deputy position within the Office of Homeland Security.
Well, I think the Office of Homeland Security is one of the most frightening things that we have. In fact, are you going to be doing a program on that in the near future?
Yes.
A paper on it?
Yes. I'll be covering this particular CIA operative in detail and his background in the next World Affairs Brief, because this is disturbing when you have these kinds of dark side operators like Richard Armitage, as Deputy Secretary of State, running around. I mean, this is a criminal. This is a person who was the drug importer for the CIA all during the Vietnam era. And here he's been elevated to Deputy Secretary of State. And now you have, another CIA operative in second position there in Homeland Security. And this can only mean that their expertise is, going to be used to eliminate opposition someday.
Well, I fear that you may well be right, and yet we really have no alternative other than to continue to try to tell the truth and rely upon the Lord for protection.
Absolutely, and I think that a remnant will be protected. I am not one of those optimistic about being able to save the entire country at this point. I'm fighting as if we have to save. You know, I'm not laying down dying any more than you are, but I think that we must not deal in illusions of peace or illusions of victory when we need to be preparing for a takedown, if you understand my meaning. In other words, if you keep acting as if you're always going to win and you never prepare to retreat, then you'll be ill-prepared when the inevitable comes.
Amen to that. Well, our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. Joel, would you like to put out your telephone number or your website so people would know how to get in touch with you if they would be interested in getting your World Affairs Brief?
Yes, the best way to find out about the World Affairs Brief is to go to my website, www.joelskousen.com. That's J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N. And there you can learn about my World Affairs Brief, some of the books that I've written on, I've got kind of a dual career, both in law and political science, represented by my World Affairs Brief, and then I worked as a high security architect for many years and wrote the book The Secure Home, as well as Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places. Partly because I knew that this conflict would arise to the time when conservative Christians would need to know how to protect themselves, how to disappear if need be, how to work within an underground, all within, you know, good law and moral principles. And so I've tried to put out books that help people prepare in a very solid way. And, so all that's on my website. Now, if you don't have access to the web, they can call my office, which is at area code 801-224-4746. And there you can ask for free samples of the print edition of the World Affairs Brief, which comes out at the end of each month, for those that don't have access to the web.
All right, and it's always got very, very provocative information on it. There is certainly no newsletter quite like it, and we always read it through from beginning to end. When it does come on a weekly basis, we've got Richard calling in from Miami. Hi, Richard. It's getting pretty late back there, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, but you know I'm a nocturnal person, Dr.
Right, okay.
I wanted to touch just briefly, I'll be brief, on Revelation 17. It says, the woman, which is a powerful city, nation, state in the end times, is sitting on the beast. Now, sitting here is like a king sitting on a throne. She is reigning for the beast. On 17:7, it says, at the same time, the beast is carrying the woman, supporting. How? Through a trade deficit, which is a theme of chapter 18. But nevertheless, the beast hates the woman and will sacrifice her so that the New World Order, it appears that America is going to be sacrificed at the altar of the New World Order.
Well, the symbolism in the book of Revelation sometimes is very, very difficult to interpret, but as I read Revelation 17 and 18, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence in the future, and yet, of course, realization that God is in charge and that he understands what's going on, and he knows the future, and, of course, he will look after his children one way or the other. It doesn't mean we may not be, if it's a difficult time, it may not be that we won't survive. But the important thing is that we will spend eternity with him. And I believe that much in the book of Revelation, or in the Revelation, I should say, is pointing, maybe I'm just overly pessimistic, but I think it's talking about America. What are your thoughts on that, Joel? Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Well, I do feel that the author, your caller, has a real excellent point. I think the New World Order intends to sacrifice the United States for the global objective. I don't see in prophecy the United States playing a major role in the end times. You know, we are playing a major role right now in terms of lifting up and supporting the creation of Israel and supporting, but at some point the U.S. gets taken out of the picture, and I think that's going to happen in this next war when the globalists instigate a war against America to have America's military destroyed. Then America, as a third world nation, that is, that has lost its superpower status, gets harnessed in the New World Order and gets absorbed, and our globalist leaders then take their position from a European base and begin to direct all the world's resources against Israel, which will be the next target. But I think that the United States, as a nation is going to get sacked, but that does not mean that all the good people are going to be destroyed. I think the remnant will continue to fight in a way in which the Lord will inspire, in a way in which the Lord will help gather a remnant to serve, whether it's in an underground or in some opposition mode. But as a nation, I don't see us taking the role that we have been. As Rome fell, so the United States is going to fall.
Okay, anything else, Richard?
Let me ask Joe one more question. I believe the ten horns are probably the divisions that the Club of Rome is designing for the world. Do you know if that has a leg power? That's my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to think that those ten horns are the ten basic states surrounding the European Union, or what's going to end up being the ten that predominate after the global government, which will be centered in the European movement there, takes over in the last days. And I see the United States being absorbed in under that in some way.
And I think that what's taking place now in Johannesburg, South Africa, this Rio plus 10 meeting is going to have a profound impact on the planning of the globalists for our future. Hey, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. And, of course, that's Richard calling from Miami, so it's well after 1 o'clock back there. It's almost 1 o'clock. Well, anyway, Joel, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening? We've given them sort of a gloomy picture with a war in Iran coming, with the war with Iraq coming, and the possibility of expanding this into really a Holocaust in the Middle East.
Well, I would recommend, because I know a lot of your audience are believing Christians, I think we have to be very careful that we do not get suckered into the way in which Christianity has been softened to be only a soft, positive, rosy worldview. I think that real Christianity is reality. You're capable of seeing the negatives in reality and reacting to them and making correct judgments, even if those are negative judgments. And I think if Christians start to see the world as it really is, they'll get the proper inspiration to know how to react and how to maneuver in order to respond to the promptings of the Lord, how to save ourselves, both temporally and spiritually in the last days.
I agree with you totally. Well, thank you so very much. It's always a pleasure having you, and we want to get you on our other programs now that you're back, home.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye and good night. Bye. All right. That was Joel Skousen. I hope you enjoyed the program. And, of course, it's not a very nice outlook. But we're in for some real problems. We've got very real financial problems. We've got very real spiritual problems. There is a master plan. There is evil in the world. And, of course, the only thing that can counter that is our Lord Jesus Christ. And so until tomorrow at the same time, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders, to pray for God's mercy. And lastly, to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We got some great programs coming up this week. And so until tomorrow, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
I'll take them both.
I'm looking for 25.
She's giving you a very good deal.
And I just charged her. I was trying to use your own card.
What's that?